14. That's where our study will begin this evening. Looking ahead to next week, which is next year, excitingly, we'll be covering chapters 16 and 17. So if you have time over the next week, please read those two chapters. As a brief review of what we talked about last week, you'll remember that we're closing the second part of Judges, which is the main middle chunk of Judges, dealing with what we most commonly think of when it comes to the Judges, which is these epic stories of the various judge deliverers that God raised up to save Israelites from their various oppressors. Remember that the book of Judges covers about a 300-year period before the beginning of the monarchy. And last week we talked about Jephthah ended his story, how he and the Israelites achieved victory over the Ammonites, and spent some time talking about his tragic and foolish vow to sacrifice his daughter if God gave the victory over the Ammonites, which they did. They ended up achieving. Then in chapter 12, we discussed his conflict with Ephraim, which was the beginning of a sort of civil war between the Gileadites and the Ephraimites. Quickly, we talked about three judges at the end of chapter 12, and then we introduced the character of Samson. And you may remember that in chapter 13, we really didn't talk about Samson so much as his parents. His two parents, Manoah and his wife, were featured prominently in chapter 13. And chapters 13 through 16, being four chapters, is the longest we have of any judge in the book of Judges, and it's on Samson, who, if I can give my opinion, is perhaps the most disreputable of all the judges, which we'll see this evening. So mainly we talked about his beginning, the birth of Samson, and all we were told about Samson himself at the end of chapter 13 was that the Lord blessed him in verse 24 and that the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him or move him into action near his hometown of Zorah. So tonight, our plan is to talk about chapters 14 and 15. As I said, most of the previous chapter focused on Samson's parents and their interactions with the angel who came to them, initially to Manoah's wife, and told them about the son they were going to have, what restrictions he was to have in his life following those of the Nazarite vow in Numbers chapter 6, and that also he would begin to save the Israelites from the Philistine oppressors that were ruling Israel at that time. And so the Philistines are going to feature very prominently in the next three chapters, which we'll talk about this evening and then next week. So now picking up in chapter 14, Samson's story fast forwards to him as a man. In Timnah, which was near his birthplace of Zorah, there he's attracted to a woman. And was this an Israelite woman that he was attracted to? He was attracted to a Philistine woman. So you remember that he was born in Zorah, and then this woman is in Timnah. So he went down to Timnah, and there he saw this Philistine woman whom he was attracted to. These two cities here, circled, Ekron and Gath, are two of the five major Philistine cities during this time. So they were called the Pentapolis, and we'll see some more of them on a map in just a little bit. So you can see that Israel's territory and Samson, who was of the tribe of Dan, very close to the Philistines. And we can see how fraternal in a way that they were, the Philistines and the Israelites, and that not much opposition is given to this marriage between the Israelite Samson and this Philistine girl. So he's attracted to this Philistine woman, returns to his parents, and says to her, "Get her for me as my wife." The NET translates his attraction to the girl in this way: "A Philistine girl in Timnah has caught my eye." That's what Samson said to his parents. And so, as I mentioned before, Ekron and Gath are those two Philistine cities, and it's likely that Timnah was kind of like a satellite city of Ekron under Philistine control. And in that phrase, "a Philistine girl in Timnah has caught my eye," the word "her" is the first word in the Hebrew word for emphasis. So the way it's translated then is that Samson wanted this girl, this Philistine girl, and no one else. And so they initiate ancient betrothal rituals. According to these rituals, the parents were the ones required to negotiate the betrothal. But before agreeing to do so, Samson's parents expressed their concern over his choice. They balk at his request to marry this Philistine girl. They suggest that Samson look among his own people for a wife, amongst the Israelites. However, what did they stop short of doing? They stopped short of condemning his choice. They stopped short of saying, "No, this is not God's will. We know it's not because of Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 4, God expressly forbade an Israelite from marrying a non-Israelite. So that would have been this Philistine. Samson disregards their counsel, saying, "Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes." That phrase, "right in my eyes," rings very close to what we're going to read several times at the end of Judges when we read, "Everyone did what was right in his own eyes," in chapter 17 and verse 6, for example. Samson's story, then, is a case study in how not to choose a mate. And in fact, I think one of the big takeaways from Samson is how to avoid a bad relationship. Look at Samson's failure and his struggles with choosing a mate and avoid those pitfalls, and we're much more likely to succeed in our choice of a mate today. He chooses her based on appearance, despite the fact that she's from a people he's forbidden to marry. And as we'll come to see both in this story with his wife or almost wife, and especially with Delilah in chapter 16, he ignores some significant red flags in those relationships, which should have clued him into the fact that they were not compatible, like being manipulated and the selfishness. Now, could God have still achieved his purposes against the Philistines even if Samson hadn't made this choice for a spouse? Wyatt?
He uses bad people for good purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. And what I can't get over is how much more effective Samson could have been if he had chosen the better path. He could have been like an Othniel or a Barak or even a Gideon, but instead we're left to read about a very disjointed individual, very broken individual who ultimately is humiliated and suffers because of his faithlessness against God. So the Holy Spirit, through the author of Judges, now interjects in verse 4 that Samson's parents were ignorant of the fact that the Lord was working through Samson in this instance to seek an opportunity against the Philistines, since at that time the Philistines ruled over Israel. Which brings up a point from our introductory class and something we talked about even last week in relation to Jephthah's vow, and it's that God's intervention or involvement does not equal his approval or disapproval of one's action. So this episode of him marrying a Philistine woman or wanting to marry a Philistine woman, and in fact, Samson's life taken as a whole, shows that God, as Wyatt said, can use anyone or any situation to further his purposes without condoning that one's actions or the situation that they are involved in. And just take as an example how often in the book of Judges, God used the sinful nations in and around Israel to achieve his purpose, which was to oppress the Israelites, cause them to rethink their ways, and to cry out to him for help. That brings us down through verse 4. I want to pause there and see if anybody has a question up to this point or comment. Yes, ma'am.
How many times the Spirit of the Lord was upon him, but yet he had free will to choose.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
The Spirit did not force him, but it was used to give him strength, but yeah, he had the free will,
yes,
to do what he wanted.
Very good. The Spirit empowered him, gave him extraordinary strength, but that still was within his control as to what to do. Good point.
Yeah, I would just say that I look at this a little different. not that the choice was bad, but it says that in verse 4, however, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord. So, not to take free will away from Samson or the fact that he was marrying outside of his people, but it seems to me like there was involvement from God in this decision. And that's exactly what verse 4 is saying, is that this, it seems like this decision was not solely Samson's choice. It was the Lord's choice that was being made through Samson for an opportunity to get at the Philistines. So, I look at it just a little bit different. Because of the way that is framed.
Sure, yeah. That's, I think, one of those deeper things that I don't pretend to fully understand, but I appreciate you bringing that out because it's certainly as they say, God's end of the stick, what he did in order to bring this about, how he was involved or how they came together. That's all unknown. John?
So if I got to run into town and it's time for the snake to get fed that Preston has, not me, it's pretty easy for me to stop if I'm requested to do it or told to do it and pick up the rat and take it to its demise, right? Kind of a similar thing, I think, is what's happening here. He was making this decision anyway. And so the Lord used that as a vehicle for the purpose that he was seeking, i.e. a chance for him to act as a judge, as a warrior, as whatever, relative to the Philistines. And that is, but that's a huge difference from saying that God endorsed or made or influenced that decision. He's already going to town. Hey, while you're at it, why don't you whack some of these guys? That's basically what's going on here. Because we have to remember, we look at God, words like omnipotent should come to mind. That means power to do anything. Omnipotent can do anything. Yet that power is restricted by certain limitations. The divine nature can't roll back on itself and do something evil. He can't tempt a man to sin. He can't make you sin. We do that ourselves. James tells us that very clearly. In this case, is he doing something wrong to marry or want to marry this woman? Sure, he's short-sighted. He's probably egotistical. He probably is not what he needs to be in terms of making decisions. But he's already going to town, so here's the occasion to pick a fight. I think that's where we get this. This is of the Lord. At that point, the decision in Samson's mind has already been made, and now God's going to use this as the vehicle to execute a judgment.
Thank you.
That phrase of the Lord is also used in Joshua 11:20, where it says, "For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts to meet Israel in battle, in order that he might utterly destroy them." And that makes me, you know, think of Pharaoh, how the Lord hardened his heart, so that was of the Lord. But when you read that, it's not that Pharaoh had no choice, and obviously God is not, it's not a good thing to harden your heart. So that phrase of the Lord is not necessarily saying, yeah, with his endorsement, like everyone's been saying.
Thank you very much.
Let's move on now, picking up in verse 5. So now Samson and his parents traveled to Timnah. They would have gone along a route like this through the Sorek Valley to what they think is Timnah. At some point on this journey, apparently while Samson was separated from his parents because they were unaware of what he did in relation to the lion, a young lion attacks Samson, and as Janet alluded to a moment ago, in this episode, Samson is empowered by the Spirit and kills the lion with his bare hands and keeps it a secret from his parents. Why would he have done that? Kept it a secret from his parents. You know if a lion was clean or unclean under the old covenant? I'll give you a hint. It was unclean. It's a predator that neither chewed the cud or had a divided hoof, according to Leviticus chapter 11. It'll play into what we read about Samson doing with the lion later in relation to the honey. So he then arrives at Timnah, and after speaking with the girl, which translators believe involves more than just, hey, let me get to know you, more likely refers to prenuptial negotiations and not to a simple conversation, decides she was right, or the NET says it this way, in his opinion, she was just the right one. Samson then returns home, and this incident will provide the fodder for his riddle to the Philistines in a few verses from now. Interestingly, in Hebrews chapter 11, you remember if Samson is one of the ones that's mentioned? Is he one of the faithful ones from this period? Yeah. Along with Jephthah. And there's one phrase in Hebrews chapter 11 which really sticks out. And it's that some of these individuals in that list stopped the mouths of lions. But was Samson the only one on that list of faithful individuals or people who demonstrated faith that were able to conquer or kill lions? That's right, David. So remember when, and this is about 50 to 100 years from the events now, David encounters the Philistine armies and Goliath taunting and mocking and blaspheming against God. He essentially says, I've had to kill bears, and I've had to kill lions, and this Philistine Goliath will be just like one of them. So just as a side point, let me get back to where I was in my notes. So the lion was an unclean animal. He then arrives at Timnah, speaking with the girl, decides she was right in his eyes. And by talking to her directly, Samson apparently breaks the, you know, we would look at that today as him being, you know, a gentleman and being forward and courageous, going and talking to this girl, but not so in this case. Again, it was the parents who were intended to arrange for the marriage. So he's kind of short-circuiting that, breaking the social conventions of this negotiation. And some commentators indicate, and this was an indication of his parents' quiet opposition to the relationship. So now, returning to Timnah to marry the girl, Samson returns to the lion's remains, and what's there in the carcass of the lions, in the carcass of the lion? Bees, a hive, and honey. Discovers a swarm of bees in the lion's carcass. He harvests the honey from the remains, eats it, and gives some to his parents. And there again, in verse 9, it says, he did not tell them he had scraped the honey from the carcass of the lion. So remember, part of the Nazirite vow was that one under this could not come into contact with a corpse. I don't think that that included a non-human corpse, as far as my reading goes. So some people that I read said that just by touching the carcass of this lion, that broke his Nazirite status. I don't know if that's the case, but he's eating something that's come into contact with an unclean animal. And so in that way, he's certainly flirting with breaking his Nazirite status before God. This is just a picture of grapevines, and can you imagine, first of all, what was he even doing in a vineyard or near a vineyard when he was supposed to be avoiding grapes altogether? But here he is in a vineyard like this, and can you imagine how scary that would be to have a young lion attack you in a place like that? So now his father and Samson returned to Timnah, this is now verse 10 that we're at, to continue the marriage ritual, and this time they'll hold a feast. And so this was likely a seven-day Philistine drinking festival, which would, again, his participation in that, prohibited by his Nazirite status. This time, there was an Israelite custom. Whether it was an Israelite custom or a Philistine one is unknown, and it's significant that, as you read through it, it doesn't seem like any of Samson's family or friends come with him, because the Philistines supply him with 30 companions for Samson for this marriage feast. So now we have Samson parting with the enemies of God, intending to marry a Philistine. Gone are the days of Othniel, Barak, Deborah, and Gideon, who led great forces against Israel's enemies. Now Israel's judge is in bed with the enemy, almost literally. And this account, again, speaks to the further deterioration in the character of the nation of Israel, and it's further proof of that downward spiral that we've talked about before, probably reaching its lowest points during Samson's reign. So at this feast, Samson presents the attendants with a riddle, and he promises them 30 changes of clothes if they could solve it, but if they couldn't solve the riddle, he would get 30 changes of clothes from them. They agree, and Samson poses the riddle. What's interesting, as we'll read through the rest of the account, is that both Samson's riddle, their response, and then Samson's response to the response, which I'll show you in a minute, are all six words, two lines in Hebrew. So that's what it looks like translated literally from Hebrew into English. Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. So what was Samson referring to in that riddle?
His fight with the lion.
Yeah, so the honey harvested from the lion. Now, not only did his parents not know about that, but certainly these Philistine partiers wouldn't have known about it either. So you can imagine getting a riddle like that, and they think on it for a few days. They're unsuccessful in trying to solve the riddle. So they threaten Samson's soon-to-be wife and demand that she tell them the answer to the riddle. How do they threaten her? What do they tell her that they're going to do if she doesn't give them the answer? Yeah. Burn her and her family. And so she's greatly distressed, as one can understand, in a situation like that with such a threat. Accuses Samson of not loving her, saying, "You only hate me for telling a riddle to the Philistines but not revealing its answer to her." Ultimately, she nags Samson to the point of revealing the riddle's answer. So then she tells that solution to the Philistines. And so they come back to Samson and say, in English, what is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? Which, again, is six words in Hebrew. And almost immediately, Samson's response is also six words, two lines, which is, if you had not slept or plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. And so that, calling a woman a heifer, is as much an insult then as it is today. So don't think that in some way he's complimenting his would-be wife. That's a terrible thing for him to have called her. But his response indicates they knew exactly how they came to solve the riddle. And at this juncture, the Spirit again empowers Samson, and instead of doing anything else, completing this marriage to the woman, apparently, he goes to Ashkelon, which is one of those five major cities I mentioned before. The two that I mentioned previously were Gath and Ekron, and then there's Ashdod, Ashkelon, and the last one is Gaza, and that's where Samson will meet his end, is in Gaza, which is not on this map. So those are the five major cities of the Philistines back during this time. This time, though, in Ashkelon, he doesn't battle a lion, but travels there and kills 30 men. He takes their garments to give back to the men at Timnah in fulfillment of his part of the pledge, since they had solved the riddle, even though they used wrong means to do that. So then it says, Samson in hot anger returns to his father's house. The NET says he was furious, leaves his wife behind, or his almost wife, at her home in Timnah. Some say that their marriage was never consummated, and that'll come into play in the next chapter when he goes back to his wife with a young goat, try and make peace for what he had done, but his father had already given her in marriage to someone else. It's unclear exactly the nature of their relationship, whether they actually got married or were stopped just short of it. It's possible that it remained unconsummated, their marriage, because she's given in marriage to another one who had been one of his companions. So after all these machinations and all these efforts to secure this Philistine wife, he wanted her so bad, now he discards her and returns home in anger. So easy to see and to say this was not true love from Samson. Which, again, keep that in mind when we talk about Delilah, because it'll say Samson loved Delilah. Well, just look at the way he loved his previous wife or almost wife. Real quickly, so remember, Samson's from Timnah, which is near the Sorek Valley, and David's battle with Goliath is down here in the Elah Valley. And so that's going to take place just a few decades from these events in Judges. That brings us to the end of chapter 14, so I'll pause there and see what questions or comments you have before we go on. JD?
There's a number of things that we can see are obviously bad choices by Samson, but I wonder if he, I shouldn't speculate, but he could have justified some of these things by exploiting loopholes. As far as I could tell, the Philistines were not considered Canaanites. They were not in the list of peoples who they were not to marry. But the very purpose that God gave them for not marrying with those peoples applied just as well to the Philistines. They were idol worshipers, and they would influence the Israelites to sin. So if you look at God's principles that he laid down, it's obvious you shouldn't have married her. But if you're trying to justify yourself to do what you want, there's an out. Maybe the same with the lion. He didn't eat the lion, but God gave principles about if an unclean, like a lizard or whatever, falls into a water jar, what do you do about that to cleanse it? Because it makes that thing unclean. So there are principles that God showed clearly what he wanted that Samson should have been able to take and apply to each of these situations, even if they weren't spelled out in the exact same scenario that he encountered.
Good point. I appreciate that. Yeah. If we can't say definitely that he violated God's law in one area, he certainly flirted with violating it. And so that's a lesson for us, is that, you know, don't even get close to the fire because you're likely to get burned. So I appreciate you bringing that out. Anybody else have a comment or question before we get into next chapter? All righty. All right. So now at the beginning of chapter 15, we're told that it's around the time of the wheat harvest, which would have been in the month of May for us. Samson returns to Timnah to be with his wife. There, as I mentioned previously his would-be or actual father-in-law doesn't allow it, saying that he had thought Samson hated her and that he had given his daughter in marriage to Samson's companion, but he offers Samson an alternative, one of his other daughters, which Samson apparently refused. As I said before, it's difficult to know what Samson's legal status was in regard to the woman in Timnah. If you know in Hebrew, as in Greek, the words for woman and wife are the same. It's apparent that Samson believed that either he was married to her at this point, or he presumed that she would still be waiting for him after his little fit and then returning home and coming back to this. So now Samson's angry again, and he seeks revenge. He catches 300 foxes or jackals. I love some of the commentators say, well, foxes are solitary creatures, so it would have been really difficult to capture 300. And I was like, well, how easy would it have been to capture 300 of any kind of animal and tie them together two by two? But nevertheless, he captured 300 animals, tied them in pairs, and before doing that said, this time I shall be innocent in regard to the Philistines, which to my reading indicates he had some measure of guilt about his previous action against them. Puts a torch between each pair of them and sets them loose on the Philistines' grains, which kept grain vineyards and olive groves. Apparently does a lot of damage because the Philistines react very strongly to this. This is just a picture of stacked grain during a harvest. So you can imagine something dry like that catching fire would have affected all the other plants around it, like the grapevines and olive trees as well. Philistines inquire who had done the damage to their crops, and they're told that it was Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite. So what's their initial reaction in retribution against Samson? Sadly, they do to his wife, or almost wife, what she was trying to avoid in the first place. They kill her and apparently their family by burning them. And so in response to that, Samson says, because you did this, I will get revenge against you before I quit fighting. Samson defeats more of the Philistines before fleeing to the cleft of the rock at Edom. That brings us down through verse 8. So all this is an escalation. And yes, Samson is warring against Philistines, which are God's enemies. He's making inroads, causing upset, beginning to create problems with them, which was what God wanted him to do. But as far as Samson goes, what he says is all this is in retribution for what they did to him. Nowhere, as far as I can read, is Samson saying, I'm doing this on behalf of the Lord and his charge as his judge to avenge the Israelites from their oppressors. It all seems like Samson's in it for vengeance. So now, based on that, some of the Philistines traveled to Judah. They raid Lehi. The men of Judah, these are again Samson's own fellow Israelites, go to Samson. They ask, why is it that the Philistines are upset about this? What then is this that you have done to us? It just speaks to, again, the degradation of their society, that they're not aligning themselves with Samson, their judge-deliverer, nor do they acknowledge their responsibility to break free from the rule of these Philistines. But what they're just trying to do is bind him and hand him over to the Philistines. Samson's simple response to them is, as they did to me, so I have done to them. Again, just in vengeance and retribution is how he's acting. No mention of God working through him to suppress the Philistines, but summarizing his actions as vindictive. So again, the Judahites, men of the tribe of Judah, does it tell us how many of these men came to talk to Samson in the narrative? Wyatt? Verse 11, which is 3,000. So why do you think so many men were needed to go talk to Samson? Probably because they knew he was a live wire. And if they didn't have a big group of people, they were liable to, or subject to, get killed by him. So they tell Samson they only intend to bind him, hand him over to the Philistines. And again, this speaks volumes of the current state of affairs in Israel. We're so far removed from the sentiments of Deborah and Barak and their song in verse 5. Remember in verse 2 where it said in chapter 5 that the leaders took the lead in Israel, that the people offered themselves willingly. Bless the Lord. So far removed from that. So the men from Judah, again, assure Samson they will only bind him and hand him over. So they do, with two new ropes, and bring him up from the rock. These were the ropes considered to be the strongest because they had not been worn or been frayed. All right. I know I blew through those verses, but I want to hear if anybody has a question or comment on that before we move along. I kind of jumped the gun with the picture up here, but if you did the reading, you know what happens. All righty. So Samson's brought to Lehi, and there the Philistines shouted as they approached. Some say that that word shouted is them raising a battle cry, and that possibly the Philistines were using this incident as a ruse to inflict a military defeat on Judah. We don't know that for sure, but it may explain why the Spirit now again empowers Samson. His bonds are loosed, and he uses a donkey's jawbone and kills 1,000 men of the Philistines, which is depicted here in the painting. So Samson marks the occasion with a poem, disposes of the jawbone. That place is referred to as Ramath Lehi, meaning the hill of the jawbone. So that poem that I referenced in verse 16, he says, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey have I struck down 1,000 men." So in this we can see Samson has a little bit of a knack for poetry. And that second line there, which at least in the ESV is translated heaps upon heaps, the exact meaning of it is uncertain. Some say that it could be translated differently. It could be translated to say, "I have made donkeys of them," or "I have thoroughly skinned them," or "I have stormed mightily against them." But he's marking the occasion with a poem in celebration of his defeat over these Philistine warriors. That brings us down to the end of 17. So we really just have the last three verses of the chapter left. I want you to notice, and Janet mentioned this earlier, how the Spirit of the Lord is empowering Samson. He's giving him the supernatural strength, and we've seen that several times over in chapters 14 and 15, but he's going to be noticeably absent from chapter 16. I don't think we read one time about Samson being empowered by the Spirit in chapter 16, and that, of course, follows the events with Delilah, which we'll talk about next week. We just had the last three verses of the chapter to cover, so I want to pause there and see what questions or comments you have. Wyatt?
About chapter 16, I kind of think in verses 28 and 29, after he says, "Please give my power back to me one more time," that's what happened.
That the Spirit empowered him to do what he was about to do?
To do his final act.
Right. That's possible, although not stated explicitly, but it's certainly possible. Also, you know, there was a reference in chapter 16 and verse 22. Of course, he was undone by the shaving of his hair. And in verse 22, it says the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. And so they're teasing the possibility that his strength would return to him at some point in the future, likely in his final act against the Philistines. But
all right, what else? Comments or questions? Last three verses of chapter 15, Samson is so exhausted by these events that he cries out to God saying, "You have granted this great salvation by the hand of your servant, and shall I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" Again, lots of parallels. I didn't mention this before, but there's parallels here with what's going on at his cry on this occasion with the cry that he'll make at the end of his life, which Wyatt mentioned just a moment ago, and we'll talk about next week. But didn't you also see some parallels in the way that his wife interacted with him and how Delilah interacts with him in chapter 16? So Samson, in that instance, with regard to how his wife or almost wife interacted with him, did not learn lessons that he should have learned, because he should have been able to avoid the pitfalls that he ended up stumbling into with Delilah, but he fell almost right into the exact same trap with her as he did with his Philistine wife. In chapter 16, verse 28, again, he'll call out to the Lord, again, the only two times that it's recorded he did this, and say then, "Please remember me and please strengthen me only this once, O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes." So on this occasion, when he's dying of thirst or thinks he's dying of thirst, God splits open the basin at Lehi and provides water for Samson there. Samson recovers his strength and is revived, and that location is renamed in Hakori, meaning the spring of him who called. Again, just to note some similarities with another Old Testament example, on another occasion in the past, not an individual, but the Israelites cried out to God because they were thirsty and in the wilderness, and he provided water from the rock for them at Rephidim, which was renamed Meribah, and that's in Exodus chapter 17. So interestingly, at the end of chapter 15 and verse 20, it says, and he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years, which so far in our reading has been very typical of the end of the account of the judge. But this is not the end of Samson's story. The end of Samson's story is in chapter 16. And we can all agree that with what we've talked about so far in relation to the judges, that Samson was an atypical judge. In this statement, you notice that it doesn't say that the land had rest these 20 years. And again, as far as my reading goes, Samson was pursuing endeavors more along the lines of a personal feud with the Philistines, constantly battling them. And again, it was like a one-man show. It was Samson against the world. He wasn't calling others of his Danite brethren or others from other tribes to battle the Philistines. He was going at it alone. So he's a complicated figure. I think we, again, can agree on that. And to my reading, Samson's a man driven by lust and revenge. And in that, it's really complicated to think about Samson. What should we think about Samson? How did God think about Samson? You know, despite the fact that God empowered him to achieve these great feats of strength, ultimately he was undone by his own faithlessness. And I'm jumping the gun a little bit to what we're going to talk about next week. But ultimately he divulges the secret to Delilah and tells her that if his head is shaved, that he will lose his strength, and that happens, and he does, and is humiliated and defeated in a way after that. And God's able to use this imperfect man to begin to save Israel from their Philistine oppressors. And one thing I can't help but notice is that very prominently in Samson's story are strength and courage. It takes, obviously he was given strength, but it also takes courage to do the things that he did. But those two qualities, while good, are not enough in and of themselves. We can see that in Samson, they're not enough to be pleasing to God. They must be coupled with one's sincere desire to please God with one's actions and also to help others become closer to their Creator, which again, were noticeably absent from Samson's life as far as I can see it, maybe up until the very end. So before I get to the takeaway for this evening, I want to know, does anybody have a concluding comment or question on Samson? Yes, ma'am.
Thinking about this jawbone of a donkey and how, you know, you would kill with just the jawbone of a donkey, but apparently if it was fresh, it had some elasticity about it that would enable you to do that. So okay. Yeah. I don't know. When you think about that, you think, how did he do that with just that?
But, right. Yeah, that's a good point. Not an ideal weapon. It kind of models or echoes Shamgar's action. So he killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad at the end of chapter 3 in Judges. And that it's fresh, the jawbone, you know, the text does know that it's fresh. So if it was old, it might be brittle and easier to break. But you're right, that is an odd choice for a weapon, especially to kill so many people. What else?
Not supposed to touch corpses. I would assume him killing all these people is not in line with that, right? Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know, it's hard to see how that could be the case. And so that's the thing. You know, we're not explicitly told that he came into contact with grapes or grape products, wine, or that he touched a corpse of a human, although, as you mentioned, it'd be hard to imagine him battling and not doing that. But really, the nail in the coffin is the hair. So that was like the last tenet of the Nazirite vow. And once that was done, then it says the Lord left Samson. Very briefly, our takeaway for this evening focuses on Samson's parents and the fact that they refused to condemn his relationship with the Philistine woman. You know, J.D. brought up a good point that in Deuteronomy 17, the Philistines are not explicitly mentioned as a people group that the Israelites were forbidden to marriage. And so you have to then assume that they're part of the Canaanite category. And if that's the case, since they dwelt in Canaan, then my take is that he would have been forbidden from marrying the woman. But nevertheless, even if it wasn't strictly condemned, still was a terrible idea. Parents might justify it, as we sometimes do today, you know, saying, well, they're just going to do what they're going to do anyway, so what's the point of condemning it or speaking out against their actions? And so for us, we do others a great disservice by not sharing God's will frankly and lovingly with people when they're heading down a dangerous spiritual path. So I don't want us to be like Samson's parents who, yes, they balked at his choice a little bit, they said a little bit, but they really didn't, as far as my reading goes, take a firm enough stand against their son's choice. And in doing so, I would say, enabled that poor choice. We likewise can enable other sins today by not standing up against them. Instead, we must help others avoid and overcome their struggles, which, if you look at the life of Jesus, was, you know, big, big part of his mission was helping people come out of sin and come into fellowship with God. All right, that brings us to the end of our class for tonight. Thank you all very much for your participation and for your